Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, the 5th of June, 2000. We are in the fireside room today with Lars Clausen and Bob Ekblad, who they begin their series, Working Out a Livable Faith, with session CLLA 2000-1, Getting Out from Theologies That Oppress. Let's listen in.
To this week of sessions that we've got together, that Bob Ekblad and myself, Lars Clausen, will be doing, and what's the title of it again?
Working Out a Livable Faith.
That's it. We thought that was a nice title. Just can't remember it. But I got to meet Bob here last year, and I've enjoyed Bob ever since. And usually when we get talking and the kids are running around, there's five of them between us. Ann doesn't really count on me for looking after the kids much anymore, because I'm always just yakking with Bob. We're talking about the kind of stuff that we want to be talking about this week. And Bob has, Bob's work is in Burlington right now. His background is as a Presbyterian pastor. He got his theological studies in France. And we were there visiting, and Stacy, I know you've been there too in Burlington. Bob and Gracie's work is with migrant farm workers up from south of the border. Both people who are working in the fields and then those who have ended up in prison. And so what kind of a theology do you use to kind of be in relationship there? How do you do this kind of stuff? How do you work out a livable faith for ourselves? But I was up in the library with Kariana and Kai the other day. Have you all seen, some of you seen these things? They're called magic eyes. Yeah. Who's seen magic eyes? Raise your hand if you have.
If you can see the picture or if you've actually seen
okay.
it before.
So if you've seen.
Well, I can't see the picture.
All right, who can do it? Who can
you
find
mean, this? Or you find several pictures.
Yeah. I can. You can do that.
Okay. I don't know. I've
all right, you three try to find that picture. You three try to find it. Or you two each here. You two work on this
picture.
Okay.
You see me think?
Find someone who knows what you're supposed to do here. And then try to find your pictures here. We'll just take a second for this. But I want to do it because, for me at least, it sort of sets the theme for the week.
Can we look at the other side? Can we pick which side we want?
Sure. So are you explaining it to people who've never done it before?
You're supposed to find the picture within the picture,
almost
right?
There.
Yeah. Your eyes have to kind of refocus.
I don't know what I saw, but
there's a picture within the picture. You weren't close.
I saw something.
What is it, Esther?
I haven't seen it yet. My eyes are
well, you can see some of the Mickeys are overlapping here.
But then it's probably in Walt Disney's things.
There it is. It's coming in for me. Anybody else?
I see this thing three-dimensional. That's what it is.
I've got a burro.
A what?
I got a mule.
Is that really what it is?
They're all different. But there's a picture in there.
But is there a key to what the pictures are?
So that you know you're right if you say it's a mule?
You can see it, you'll know it. If you looked at this, you'd see the mule too.
See some justice.
Your eyes have to kind of unfocus on this. You can, one way to do it is just put it up really close and slowly draw it away. But what happens is there comes this new way of seeing. Okay, and once you see it that way, once you see it, you'll never see it the same way again.
Right.
All right. My experience with, if you want to call it the theology of the cross, theology of glory, whatever it is, once you see it, you will never read the scriptures the same way again. Okay? Now Bob's just going to be spending all hour doing that.
Three dimensions, but I don't see any pictures.
They're up in the children's library. But that at least has been the case for me, that as I start to be exposed to this theology of the cross, I see the scriptures in a new way, I see life in a new way. I've not been able to see it the same way again.
I've never been in here.
You're welcome to keep fiddling with these things, but there's a change. You know, I'm looking at the same thing. I'm looking at this picture, but after a while, it's a different picture. So, working out a livable faith, and the title of this one is Getting Out from Under
Theologies That Oppress.
Theologies That Oppress. So,
all right, I have a handout for you guys to get started with this part. You just take this to the front one that's not both sided, and another that has one side.
Bob's got some introduction, but a major piece of this week in terms of working out is our spending the time working it out and our input and our conversation. So.
All right. Well, today what I thought, Lars and I thought we'd do is present in broad strokes what we call street theology, which is kind of the dominant theology that's out there. And I have been surprised to find this theology not just among the inmates with whom I work and the farm workers, but also among peasants in Honduras. And I teach at a place called Regent College, a graduate school of theology in Vancouver. I teach a course called Reading the Bible with the Damned. And my classes, I had about 20 different nationalities in my last class. So people from all over the former Soviet Union. I mean, I had Ukrainian students and Lithuanians and Japanese and someone from Singapore. Anyway, many of them expressed, when we went through this this description of what I call street theology, which is sort of the dominant theology out there, they expressed, I mean, they told me that this resonated with what they'd experienced in their countries as well. So some people have said, since I work mostly with Latin Americans, this must be something that comes from the Catholic Church. That's a typical response in Protestant churches anyway. But I don't think that's the case. I think this is, I would call, this image of God, which I'm going to describe as kind of what would be typically called theism, I guess, just a description of God as all-powerful outside of Jesus Christ, outside of the revelation of Christ. Anyway, I'd like to kind of go through this. These are just some impressions that I have of how people view God who I work with. And, you know, some of you may resonate with this, other things might appear obviously sort of incorrect or you've gotten beyond this. But what we'd like to do is kind of present this popular theology and then look at the question of how to get out from underneath these theologies through looking at a text from Mark's Gospel, which Michael's been presenting in the mornings. And we're choosing a text that he isn't going to study, so. So anyway, I'd like to just kind of read through this a bit and then feel free to stop me at any point. Assumptions of street or popular theology. Many people outside the churches have negative images of God. Ideas about God come from people's parents, past church experience, and the media. On the other hand, negative images of God are universal, transcending cultures, nationality, and religion. While there is some truth in many street-level views of God, usually there are distortions that keep people from experiencing love, forgiveness, healing, and true Christian freedom. The dominant images of God may not be perceived as negative. Okay, that's if someone is successful at living up to these images of God, or to this kind of God, they might, you know, many successful religious types embrace these images of God as the correct images. Okay, so they're not, they don't feel oppressed by them, although I think many of them would still be oppressed by them because they're in denial of their own inability to conform to this type of God. So anyway, the impact of this dominant theology is relative to the audience. It's clearly negative for the poor and underclass, although there are poor folks who are successful religious types too, plenty of them actually. So, but in general, those that make up the underclass, people who struggle in the jails and in on the streets of our cities, people who I work with anyway, a lot of heroin addicts, right? Folks in who are drug dealers and drug users and gangbangers and your typical campesino male, especially down in Central America, these people, it's all bad news for them, for sure. And on the other hand, positive and quite convenient for the dominant class. I believe that these assumptions must be directly questioned and challenged by an engaged street gospel. And if the theologian or pastor is not aware of these assumptions, how can the message be appropriate to the addressees? So anyway, let's look at some images of God. I've kind of broken this down into theology, and then on the back, cosmology, anthropology, soteriology, or how salvation happens, ecclesiology, a view of the church, and sin and ethics, which I kind of put together for some reason. I kind of have a problem with ethics or something. Anyway, theology. Most people who I encounter envision God as all-powerful. And I'm a Presbyterian, and we sort of are known for starting out with the theology of God as creator and really being into the all-powerful God who is sovereign, all-knowing, and omnipresent, omnipotent. And you guys have heard of the tulip, you know, for the Dutch Calvinists. And that's clearly the kind of the critical underpinnings of their theology is a high view of God. So anyway, everything that happens to people or to creation is considered to be God's will. Whatever happens in their lives, good or bad, is often attributed to God. Some people have money and power because God wills it, possibly because they're good. Others who suffer must deserve it. And this is something that is so deeply rooted in the minds of the folks that I work with. The Hurricane Mitch sweeps through Honduras. Okay, it's rare the person who wouldn't have said that wasn't God's will. It was clearly God's will. And many would say, well, it's a punishment from God. In fact, the evangelicals in Central America use that very effectively, and their churches swelled in numbers. You know, they said, you think that was bad, just wait till the final judgment comes. Okay, so if you're poor, it's because you must be bad. Or you must have gone astray somewhere. If you are rich, well, God blesses rich people and punishes poor people. God demands moral perfection and conformity to the laws of the land. God is distant, judging, angry, punishing, dissatisfied, and impatient, especially with those who do not conform to his and society's demands. God's love, presence, and blessing are conditioned on people's good behavior. God's will is seen as equal to that of the legal system, jail, police, capitalist system. That's also very deeply rooted among the folks that I work with. And the typical person in jail would say, well, God has me, you know, in jail, and God knows why I'm in jail. You know, and they get religious to try to get God to lighten up. You know, sometimes they come to the Bible study and they're afraid sometimes to be really honest about what they really think because they think that God might get mad and give them more time in jail, you know, or in prison or something. But there's all kinds of variations of this, you know, up into the other social classes, like, you know, my parents who, when they lost everything, they went chapter 7. I remember my mom saying maybe it was because we didn't tithe enough. You know, and she's a person who's, you know, much more... has been a person of privilege and, you know, who would be a typical sort of Holton Village visitor. So anyway, I'll go through the rest of the theology part, then I'd like to get your reactions. Since God is all-powerful, then the status quo, the powers, authorities, social class divisions, must be God's sovereign will. If a person is picked up by the DEA on drug charges, by the Border Patrol for being undocumented, or by the police for any crime, these are the folks I work with again. God is seen as the invisible behind-the-scene force who ultimately is responsible for their predicament. I guess I already mentioned this. God has me here in jail. When my trial comes, we'll see what God wants. Okay, so people's associations between God and the prosecutor, the judge, the police, or the INS are usually covert. They're not, like, up front. So if I ask them a direct question, like, well, so God picked you up? Who was it that put the handcuffs on you? Was that God? And they'll say, oh, no, it's the Mount Vernon police. And they'll smile. And you know, but underneath it, the deeper level, it's God who's doing everything. So anyway, number 3, God is like the head of immigration, carefully guarding the borders of the kingdom of heaven, allowing only people who have met the demanding requirements to enter, hunting down and expelling illegals. And the church, if we move quickly to ecclesiology, the church is seen as the guardians of the borders, you know, like Border Patrol agents who are on the ground making sure that only the right folks are allowed in, and that the wrong folks are brought to the door and expelled. That's how the church is viewed, I'd say, that by 90% of the people I work with. So God is just, so everything that happens must be our just deserves. God is not experienced as good. That's just not even an idea in the thinking of the people who I work with. God is a righteous judge who is easily angered by rebellion and severely punishes disobedience. God is a cosmic police force. So I'll keep moving through this really quick. I guess it's all related. Cosmology, this is the question of where is God located vis-a-vis the creation of human beings. For these folks, God is distant, detached from our suffering. When asked about God's location, many will shrug, and some will say he's everywhere. God is everywhere and nowhere. People often think and feel they are responsible for God's absence. They often think that God has left them because they're bad, or that they've separated themselves from God because of their behavior. Anthropology, a high theology makes it sound like it's a good theology. A theology of God is out there and all-powerful and dominant, kind of presupposes a low anthropology. It's like the bigger and more distant judging God is, the smaller and more insignificant and kind of humiliated versus humble are humans, okay? So the anthropology would be people are bad, deserving whatever calamity befalls them. We're damned. Most of the people I work with in the jails, especially, they would say, if you ask them what they thought about their eternal kind of where they were going to go if they died, most would assume that it's not, not to heaven for sure. A few people might say, maybe there's hope for me because I'm reading my Bible every day now that I'm in the jail. I'm going to the Bible studies and I've even been fasting. But it's all merit, which brings us to D, how salvation happens. Salvation depends on our ability to measure up to God's commandments. Someone who is saved does not drink, does not get drunk, does not smoke, rob, fornicate, etc. There's a big list. And of course, homosexual activity is definitely in the list too for the average person out there on the streets. Just so many things. I mean, the length of the list sort of distinguishes a lot of the denominations or the churches, the grassroots churches that are working with the underclass throughout the world. In Honduras, for instance, there's a lot of little churches that are the churches made up of very, marginalized folks. But they distinguish themselves from the others by how many rules they have. We're the serious Christians. We believe in going to church every single day. Or someone else, we're more serious. We don't eat pork, and we speak in tongues, and we go into trances during our worship services, and we don't even associate with Catholics. And the list is sort of what makes people, what distinguishes people, and makes what the denominations. And of course, the Roman Catholics, the Liberationists, they would say, well, we're Christians, and that means uniting and organizing and overthrowing the rich. And then the more traditional Catholics would say, no, what's significant is that you just comply with, you go through a different sacramental system. I mean, you confess every week and you do whatever's required to get to benefit from the sacraments. But what distinguishes everyone is basically ethics. That's why I have a hard time with ethics, maybe. So anyway, if I don't or can't comply, if I'm just too messed up, like I'm an alcoholic or something, and I get out of jail and I just can't resist the alcohol, well, it must be because I'm not chosen, because I have accepted Christ. I've raised my hand in one of those services. But since I can't keep my act together, it must be because I'm not one of the chosen. Many are called, few are chosen. Those who fail to live up to the divine law are destined for hell. God can heal and save on the spot if we have enough faith. If we haven't been immediately delivered from drugs, alcohol, or any other vice, it's because we don't have enough faith. God calls, only calls, helps, and answers the prayers of good people. So it follows that the church, ecclesiology here, is made up of those who think they've succeeded in complying with God's commandments, though most people outside the church know they haven't. The church is seen as a place for those who can measure up, or at least claim to God's law. The church is made up of good people, those who successfully follow the Bible, obey the laws, and are making it in the world. The church is welcoming to people like them only if they change, stop smoking, drink, and get married, hide their tattoos or whatever, or fill up their extra earring holes on their in their cheeks and noses and ears or whatever. Well, do whatever it takes to look like everybody else, more or less. Salvation is what God gives to those who deserve it, because they've lived a good life by following the law, obeying the Bible, and regularly attending church. So sin and ethics, again, it's just obvious. God wants us to obey the authorities and the powers. God will punish those who disobey. Fear is the best motivator for repentance and conversion. Salvation is up to people's choice. If we comply with God's law in the Bible, the church's rules, and the laws of the land, we will be saved. If we don't, we cannot. Or cannot, we are condemned, damned. Sin is willful disobedience, not oppression, enslavement, or sickness. Sexual sin, IV drug use, make you unclean and shameful, unworthy of coming into the presence of God or receiving forgiveness. Goodness is willful obedience. The Bible is viewed as a rule book containing God's perfect will. The Bible is not good news. It details the divine law that all are required to live by in order to deserve eternal life. The Bible contains people's sentence. It tells them the negative things that will happen to them since they are evil. So why reach out, or why read such bad news? The Bible can be read expressly to find evidence for these assumptions. And this is, in fact, how most fundamentalist churches read the Bible. And this is their hermeneutical principle. I think that's enough. How do you react to that? Does this seem like an extreme sort of over-caricature that I'm offering here? Have any of you experienced this firsthand or witnessed this? Mm-hmm. Does anyone have any versions of this that they want to share?
I think of... I'll give you an example of this, but when I was working in the AIDS housing program in Seattle, there was a client that was the exact same age as me, and her name was Tracy. I'm Stacy, so there was like this mirror or almost similarity. But the things that went on in her life, how she contracted AIDS, all these things, horrible things, began very early on in her age, or in her life. And she asked me and another coworker of mine once, you know, do you believe that God answers children's prayers? And we knew what she was getting at, because she said, when I was 7 years old, when I prayed that my father wouldn't hurt me, you know, God never listened. And I obviously am not a child of God. I'm a mistake. And my view of God at age 7 was so different that it wasn't so much a theology of glory, but a theology of compassion that my parents had taught me. But how do you undo something that begins in childhood that says, you know, God doesn't listen to me, I'm a mistake, and I don't fit into the kingdom of God?
The other side of this is I remember growing up and praying, you know, God, thank you for the way you're blessing our family. You know, we lived in a very, very wealthy suburb of Seattle and had a nice speedboat. We go water skiing on every day in the summer and just had a lot of benefits, mm-hmm. just the good life and everything. And I remember, a typical sort of response to that in a Christian home is to give thanks to God for the blessing. As if that is a direct fruit of God's, you know, kind of work in our life or whatever, instead of just the benefits of being privileged, of a privileged social class and having opportunities of education and opportunities for meaningful work and things, and living in, you know, happened to having a nationality that allowed us certain opportunities, whatever.
I think about funerals, going to funerals, and it's not uncommon to hear in the sermon what a good person this was, and therefore God must really be thankful and really love them. And we had a funeral for just this incredible person in our congregation, you know, and we can give thanks for that incredibleness, but at the time of the funeral, I mean, there's just simply no distinction. Or is that where we make the distinctions? Is it because that person lived this incredible life of service to our community and 4-H clubs and the church and her children and all that stuff, that God has chosen to love her and accepts God, that God accepts this woman into the kingdom? I mean, I've heard that time and time again.
Mm-hmm. I would say this, I mean, this is our culture. Almost take the church out of it, and I know, Lars, you talked about at the campuses, I mean, there are a lot of people now who have no contact with God. So I wonder, I would judge it as saying there's something good about starting out thanking God. There's some power that is out here. But other than that, all this is, I've experienced this. This is my culture. I see that. And it's rampant through the church. Where's the real church?
Yeah. I've dealt with many inmates who have no exposure to the church at all. I mean, they haven't even darkened the door of a church in their whole life. And this is pretty much how they view God. You know, I don't know if they get it by osmosis through the media or if it's just a part of the human condition to view God this way. I kind of think it's part of the human condition.
Why do you think it makes sense to understand God in this way? And I've thought about that question a lot. I mean, why is this so dominant? It must make sense in a certain way for us. Whether we're rich and privileged or whether we're poor and oppressed, this view of God is the same. It's just one side I'm damned because it's this God, the other side is I'm blessed because it's the same God. Why does it make sense?
I think most people never acknowledge the fact that their basic view of God is their parents. And just like Stacy's story, and somebody who grew up with parents who did horrific things to them, and this is their, this is their view of God, that they're hate, that they're not a worthy person. And another person who grew up with very loving parents and has a very loving idea of what God is. I also agree, though. I think that it's specific to Christianity. The Eastern religions, the caste system in India, and which certainly serves the people who are on top in the same way. Mm-hmm. The people who are on the bottom, sorry, maybe next lifetime. And also in non-religious cultures, the Soviet Union, some other communist cultures. It is a very, it does seem like a very much a human thing to control other people. It's a power thing. And I think anything related to power definitely has something to do with people's either conscious or unconscious, unacknowledged idea of what God is. I definitely think everybody has some idea of that, whether they believe that they do or not. Mm-hmm. It's a universal thing.
I have a friend who's from Zambia, and he was actually one of my teachers. He was a TA for me this last quarter up at Regent. He told me, he said, in Zambia, I think like over 50% of the population is HIV positive. It's just a huge... staggering number of people. And he says that all these Westerners, they want to come over and they think it's all education. He said it's not education. He says it's theology. He says most people view AIDS as God's will. So they think, what can we do against God's will? He said there needs to be a transformation of people's view of God in order for there to be this resignation to HIV/AIDS to be subverted. And I saw the same thing in Honduras with the people in their poverty. I mean, the people were slash and burn farmers, and their crops were just they couldn't migrate from land from plot to plot because the population's grown so much in Honduras. People are stuck on the same plot, and
and their production is just dropping lower and lower and lower. And I remember visiting these people in their fields with the corn just stunted and yellow, and you know, just they were able to hardly, they couldn't hardly harvest a thing off it. And I'd say, well, what do you think the reason is for this this harvest, this problem that's going on in the country? They'd say, oh, we don't know. You know, we've tried everything. We've tried fertilizer. The governments have promoted in different seed varieties, you know, hybrid seeds, and you know, we can't afford the fertilizer, and you know, the hybrid seeds, there's more insect problems, and you know, we've tried this technique and that technique, and you know, it's, we just think, you know, it's la voluntad de Dios, you know, it's the will of God. And they really meant that, and so they were just like, okay, well, what can we do against the will of God? And it was only after people began to learn that there were actually some cause and effect, I mean, erosion and burning their fields, and there were reasons behind their poverty, that suddenly God was able to be liberated from these negative images of God in a way. And they were able to say, well, maybe it isn't God's will, maybe it's just that we didn't know. You know, and you know, but that's one angle, right? Education is one angle to kind of break the cycle of this attributing everything to God. But the other picture is the scriptures and kind of a rereading of the Christian tradition with this question in mind. Is this the God, you know, the good, the who? I mean, the good news that the news of victory that Mark, the Gospel of Mark announces, is this the news of victory? That we have a God, that this is the God who reigns? You know, I'm not convinced at all. In fact, that's kind of what my vocation is all about, is trying to help people envision God freshly, and to be very, to take on this God of theism or whatever, this dominant God, take him on directly. And just say, okay, well, is this the God of the Scriptures, or who is the God of the Scriptures? And that's what I'd like us to do right now, is to look at a text from Mark's Gospel.
I want to like do one more example, and just in terms of why it seems like it makes sense to me. Mike's a doctor in health, okay? So let's imagine, and you all have a job or something like that. Stacy, you're the program director here. It could be whatever, all right? So Mike's this doctor in health. Let's make me his director, okay? Every person that goes to Mike gets sicker instead of more well. What's my job to do?
You're in me.
I mean, it's the only responsible thing to do, isn't it?
Sure.
That's not your calling. You know, Stacy's the program director, and she says for everybody to end up in the wrong room. So Bob and I are here, and everybody's up in Chalet 10 expecting the thing to happen. I mean, this happens for months. What's the job of the person who's Stacy's boss? Is to say, you're not supposed to be the program. I mean, in some sense, I think that becomes then my image of God. God is the one who judges me. Well, I'm really good because I make patients the most well. You know, there must be some kind of list of sort of performance there, right? Between the better and the worst doctors. And so God, who's the judge, you know, and so I'm blessed because I do these kinds of things. The question becomes, I think, is that it? And for most of us, it's no, that is it. You know, as you said, the Border Patrol, that's just it. So God just becomes the ultimate judge. But judging it on the same basis as the director of the hospital needs to judge you and say, you're making every patient sicker, I'm sorry, but this isn't what you need to be doing. I mean, the question is there anything else or not? And the traditional answer, I think, is no. There's nothing else. That's just God.
And if it works for you, it doesn't need to be anything else, right?
If you're in the top quartile of the doctors, it's okay. But if you had spent all those years in medical school and you went out and you made every patient sicker and you're released from being there, well, then you could say, well, God is definitely a judge and I'm damned. That's one option. That's the option if that's all that's there. Is there anything more? The same question applies for a person who's successful. Is there anything more? But there's not that burning need to know because I'm successful. And you're doing just fine as a program director. But if this was just absolutely not working, is there anything more than that? Or is God simply the one who blesses those who can accomplish and curses those who can't?
we have such extremes. Like, I just read a newspaper yesterday, there was a picture of Ted Turner and Jane Fonda receiving these honorary degrees at some university. And Ted Turner was interviewed and was basically saying, you know, who am I? I'm not that wealthy compared to Bill Gates. He's comparing himself to Bill Gates as we're all looking at Ted Turner going, wow, he's way up there. He's making a lot of money, but there's always some other standard to attain to. And obviously they've found fulfillment somehow if they're that much wealthier, or that family over there that has the white picket fence, they've found fulfillment. And so I think it's in our nature, regardless of if you're Christian or not, to compare and say, they've found something else that I don't have.
My goal this year is to step one up and on the effectiveness ladder of the doctors at the Nome Hospital. Or, you know, I'm going to be better than the last three program directors in these measurable quantities. Or, as a pastor, I'm going to have this many more people come and worship this year. Blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I would want the CEO of the hospital to dismiss you. I would want that. That's, and I think that's part of the slippery thing. That has to be done.
That's deism in a way. I mean, that's atheism. Atheism is an appropriate response to this sort of theism. I remember I lived with when I was in Israel. I lived in Israel for 3 months on a kibbutz when I was 20, and I had a roommate who was Jewish, and I told them I was Jewish in order to get on this kibbutz, and I justify it based on Galatians that we're all children of Abraham. Anyway, I was reading my Bible one day, and my Jewish roommate, who was from Cuba, he just started ridiculing me. He says, what are you doing, you know, reading the Bible? I mean, how can you, a Jewish brother, just waste your time on the scriptures and after what's happened to, you know, to us, the Holocaust? And, you know, he goes, I just cannot respect you. You just make me sick. I mean, just to see you just doing that, wasting your time reading the scriptures. And I thought, yeah, you know, I had just gone through Dachau and some of the concentration camps, and I've been reading Elie Wiesel, and so I was aware of kind of where he was coming from, but I said, well, have you ever read the Torah? And he said, no, you know, why would I waste my time reading the Torah? And I said, well, if you haven't read it, I can't respect what you're saying, you know, but I'd be willing to read it with you, you know, and if it seems like it's all a bunch of bullshit, I'll drop it too. I don't want to waste my time. And that's kind of where I was at in that time in my own faith journey too, right? And so we started reading together. And little did I know, that was the beginning of my vocation in a way, reading with people who had this, you know, this bad, big God, mean God image and couldn't get out from under it. And this guy ended up sort of coming to faith in his own way. And we traveled all through Israel and read together, and it was just a wonderful experience. But, and I've seen many people over the years learn to kind of come to faith, and which for them meant learning to disassociate or to kind of make a break from this negative theology and get off from underneath this negative theology. One scripture that I often use to sort of help this happen, I mean, there's lots of them that I use. If I have a new group, say, in the jail or down in Honduras or whatever, but one text that is especially helpful is the one that I'd like us to look at right now in the next 15 minutes or so that we have. We have until 1:45, is that right? Okay, could someone read for us? But before, let me just give a little introduction here. One of the big questions is how, if you were God, okay, and you knew that you weren't this big negative God of the dominant theology, what would you do so that people who had negative images of you could perceive you differently? As you really are. If you knew, oh, I know, I love everybody. Why do they think I'm so mean? You know, and you were God, this loving, gentle, compassionate, you know, forgiving God. What would you do to kind of help break in?
Well, he sent his son.
Okay. So maybe that gives us
loving people.
What's that?
I would send loving people.
You would send loving people. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm convinced that the Gospels, they show the struggle between the dominant theology and this new, fresh, living word. I mean, this new theology that Jesus brings.
And usually the dominant theology is expressed through the words and the actions of the Pharisees, the scribes, the religious establishment in the scriptures, okay? And Jesus, his interaction with these characters and also with the people who they marginalize, you know, the lepers, the lame, the blind, just all the excluded folks, I think really shows us, I mean, if we can read it this way as a struggle, and we try to look at the theologies of the dominant theology that's expressed by these religious leaders and contrast it to who God is if Jesus reveals God, this is an angle that I think is really helpful. That's what I'd like to try to do as an experiment with you guys. Could someone read for us Mark 2, 5 to 17, and then 23 through 3, 6?
5 or 15, 17?
What's that?
Maybe you've got 15 to 17.
Yeah, I have that in there too, and then I'm skipping a little section. John 2, 15 to 17, I think that's where Jesus is with the tax collectors and sinners, yeah. And then verse 23 through 3, 6. I think if we try to be sensitive to the different theologies that are present in this text.
And as he sat at dinner in Levi's house, many tax collectors and sinners were also sitting with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. When the scribes and the Pharisees saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, "Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?" When Jesus heard this, he said to them, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I have come not to call the righteous, but sinners."
And then 23 through 3, 6.
One Sabbath, he was going through the grain fields, and as they made their way, his disciples began to pluck heads of grain. The Pharisees said to him, "Look, why are they doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?" And he said to them, "Have you never read what David did when he and his companions were hungry and in need of food? He entered the house of God when Abiathar was high priest and ate the bread of the presence, which it is not lawful for any but the priest to eat, and he gave some to his companions. Then he said to them, 'The Sabbath was made for humankind, and not humankind for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath.' Again he entered the synagogue, and a man was there who had a withered hand. They watched him to see whether he would cure him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man who had the withered hand, 'Come forward.' Then he said to them, 'Is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath, to save life or to kill?' But they were silent. He looked around at them with anger. He was grieved at their hardness of heart and said to the man, 'Stretch out your hand.' He stretched it out and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went out and immediately conspired with the Herodians against him how to destroy him."
Okay. So if we read, just based on what we've read here, who are the main characters that we see, or if we could just kind of name them all the different people and characters that appeared in this narrative. Who do we have?
Jesus.
We have Jesus.
The scribes and Pharisees. Established.
Okay. Who
the
else?
The sinners and the tax collectors.
Right.
And the less fortunate population.
Yeah. Right. We have the disciples too, right? They're plucking grains, head of grain in the fields. And then the last section.
A man with a withered hand.
All right. So, how do the Pharisees, how do they respond to Jesus' actions? What's their? This is the second. This first place where the Pharisees react is actually the second occurrence in Mark's gospel where the Pharisees are on the scene, critiquing Jesus. First one is a text that Michael's going to discuss tomorrow, I believe, where Jesus forgives a man's sin who was lowered through the roof. And the Pharisees react, okay? We have a reaction, several reactions here of the scribes and Pharisees. How do they react in this text?
Well, what he's doing goes against their conventional wisdom, goes against what they believe to be right. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's hanging around with sinners.
of the Pharisees. Like, just how does, who's the God that they depict? Who is God according to just the way the Pharisees react to Jesus, their words, their gestures, their problems they have with Jesus? What's the God, what's God like according to the Pharisees?
He's the law.
Okay, God is the law. The law or the law enforcer? Or?
Both, probably.
What else could we say? Let's try to get into some detail here.
Judgmental.
Judgmental, okay. So a judge, clearly.
And merciless, because no matter what, you have to conform to the law, even though it's ridiculous or hurts you.
Okay. So the law is of supreme importance. Okay, and God is the one who stands behind that law.
And it's not flexible. He's not flexible.
Okay.
And picky, picky, picky.
Picky. Exactly. What else? What else can we say about God?
And to use your word, he's distant.
Okay. He's a judge. He's distant.
He must not be very understanding either.
Okay, not understanding.
We don't think of him as a father. Well, maybe at least. Well, I don't think that bad. Okay, father's relative, right?
Right. Maybe like one of those really distant kind of absent fathers or something.
There you go.
Yeah.
On the positive side, you could say interested in good order.
Okay. Law enforcer, okay, so we can say interested in good order, that's...
But not, I mean, you could look at all of these, not in such a negative way, but, you know, careful who you eat with, what are you out in someone else's field picking their grain for, and, you know, take this person to a doctor.
Yeah, we often have the Border Patrol come to our office, and we have big forums where they speak with growers and activists and farm workers, and the Border Patrol will, sometimes they can sound so reasonable. They say, well, what do you think we should do? Just open all the borders and just let all of Latin America just come into our country and just overrun us? You know, and do you believe in just no borders? And some of the people will say, well, well, no. And they say, well, how are we supposed to control the situation then? And, you know, and they just, they can be really logical and descriptive of their approach and kind of, and really, they're quite excellent sometimes. I mean, some of their spokespersons, they're, politicians can be very convincing to the public.
And along that line, I think the Pharisees could be seen as a God of high faithfulness.
Okay.
You know, in a certain term. I mean, what does it mean to be faithful?
Okay, it demands...
And they're protecting the people from God, because if you do it right, he won't zap you or whatever.
So this is a God who demands serious faithfulness. This isn't a God of cheap grace, for sure.
I mean, the other thing is, let's remember, the Pharisees, by and large, are a lay theological movement. These are not the priests. These are not the pastors. These are good, hardworking, concerned, honest lay folk who love God and want to do right by God. Mm-hmm.
Yep, definitely. Now, why did the Pharisees have a hard time with Jesus eating with tax collectors and sinners? What does that tell us about their view of God?
God's holy and clean, and these people aren't.
Holy and clean, too holy to kind of get dirty and close to the masses out there, for sure. Pure, okay, too pure. For sure, to be with scummy tax collector types and sinners and prostitutes and whoever else.
He accepts the sinful behavior.
What's that?
He accepts their behavior.
God does? We're going to get to that part. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, one thing I have here, is this an inclusive God, this God of the Pharisees?
No.
Okay, so another nice word here, exclusive. I'm sorry, I'm going on the negative ones here.
Okay, the positive one would be a discerning God.
The exclusive God.
I think that's critically important to keep those words in there, because, you know, you put all those things in, oh, it's clear, it's obvious.
Right.
But then you sit there with the Border Patrol, and it's, well, how do we discern this situation?
Mm-hmm.
This stuff is so incredibly slippery to me. And, Bob, you make it clear here, which is wonderful. It's important to have that. But when it gets down to what do you do at Mike's hospital, it gets tricky.
Okay. Anyway, this is a God who is accusing. He's hard-hearted. He's watching, the all-seeing God, okay? In verse 6 of chapter 3, it says that the Pharisees went out to see how they could destroy Jesus. If the Pharisees are representatives of the God, of the true God, then this God is one who destroys heretics, who destroys people that are pushing the edges, for sure, right? All right, let's look now at, in contrast, we have in Mark's Gospel, I think number 3 here is before. In Mark's Gospel, Jesus, in many places, sometimes it's very cryptic, but many places Jesus is described as being God, okay, directly. And one of the first ways is in the second, third verse where it says, you know, that you have a citation from Isaiah where it says, I will prepare the way for the Lord. Or, you know, John the Baptist is described as preparing the way for the Lord. Okay, in Hebrew, that's a tetragram, you know, Yahweh. Okay, who shows up? It's Jesus, right? I mean, that's one example of the way that Mark identifies Jesus with God. But it's done all over the place in Mark's Gospel. Like, for instance, the fact that Jesus forgives sins. Who can forgive sins but God alone? You know, the Hebrew verb for to forgive in the Old Testament, there's only one subject of that verb, and it's always Adonai. It's always the Lord, Yahweh. Okay, so that's a clearly orthodox perspective that only God can forgive sins, okay? And then Jesus, here's Jesus forgiving someone's sins. That's another cryptic but very present identification between Jesus and the Lord. Okay, so it's not going too far to say, well, who is God? If Jesus reveals God, then what's God like? Okay, and that's what I want to ask now. In contrast to this, who is God? Who's Jesus? Who's the God that Jesus revealed?
Position.
What's that?
Position.
Okay. And you get that from the verse where it says, I didn't come to, no, which verse is that?
Those who are, 17, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick.
Okay.
Actually,
so, physician. Doctor. This isn't a designation for God in the Eastern Church, Doctor God. In some of the liturgies, God is worshipped as Doctor. We don't have that in our tradition, unfortunately. Okay, what else? What is it? Jesus' behaviors and words, what do they tell us about what God's like? Who's Jesus hanging out with?
He's concerned.
Concerned, okay.
Certainly compassionate.
Still say he's all seeing. I mean, he's concerned about those people too. He sees them and their needs.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of under concern and compassion.
Yeah. Okay. And he knows what the Pharisees are thinking in their hearts too. I mean, earlier on in the text that Michael's going to talk about tomorrow, that we have the scripture. I mean, with it saying, you know, Jesus knew what they were thinking in their hearts, and you know, was upset with them for judging him for forgiving their sin, right? Okay, but anyway, so Jesus does describe God as being all-knowing to some extent.
And he is a problem solver. He pulls people out of the mess, or feeds them, or heals them, so he's always
practical. Okay. Jesus is inclusive in contrast to the exclusive God of the Pharisees. I mean, he's got the Pharisees there, too. He's inclusive of everybody. I mean, he's got the tax collectors and sinners at table with him. He's, you know, he's got the disciples. He's got the man with the withered hand in the temple. He's got, you know, and before that, all the demon-possessed people are being brought to Jesus. He's healing just all the masses that are just coming from all over, everywhere.
Well, he came to abolish the law, and he doesn't say that in the scripture, but as far as law enforcement.
Okay, so not too concerned with the law,
right.
For sure.
And in Matthew's gospel, well, no, in Matthew's gospel, he says not one jot or tittle of the law will be taken away. But anyway, that gets us into another question about the law.
Here's about physical needs of people.
Yeah, okay. So concern, compassionate.
Example of David.
Cares about people's immediate physical needs.
And it's always moving in the direction of, like, save life.
Thrown in the side to the establishment.
Jesus, it's almost like you couldn't have more of a contrast between these two theologies.
There's a lot of, we could even get more contrast, like merciless, he's merciful, I think. Yeah. And
It seems like he looks for people's intentions.
Yes. So he's looking at the deeper underlying realities rather than just judging by appearances. He associates with all of the, actually we already talked about this, he's inclusive, but he's not too pure or too holy to associate with the dregs of the society around him, right?
Yeah, I think the sense that, I mean, maybe some contemporary, the sense of participates or accompanies them. He's not just simply saying, oh, well, you're tax collectors and sinners, hey, that's cool, have a good day. But he actually eats with them, right? Mm-hmm. Is with them. I think that that preposition with is very important, because that's also what gets him into trouble, that he's with them.
He embraces sinners, okay? Accompanies them.
But he's very angry and intolerant of people who don't see his new purpose to God.
Yeah. Okay, so he's angry with this whole approach here. Angry at the hardness of heart. Angry and grieved both. So there's anger and grief that God expresses through Jesus at the dominant paradigm, the dominant theology. So who's this good news to?
The marginalized.
It clearly is. You know, when I do a similar Bible study to this with the guys in the jail, they just can't believe it. They can't believe it. I mean, this is how they see God, okay? And then you look and you say, okay, well, who is God if Jesus reveals God? And it's just like, what? I mean, I see smiles that probably never appear on these faces. You know, related to God, your theology or Bible study, for sure. You know, for them, the Bible, you pull the Bible out and they get ready to run, you know. Or they get their gun ready or something. It's like, the Bible, It's an oppressive arm of the establishment for them, against them. And for them to hear this, it's just like, wow.
Well, it could be having to do with the definition of love, because the Pharisees loved God, and they did it by respecting him and following his commandments and having no other God before him, protecting him and not associating with the wrong crowd or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then Jesus looks at love as that compassion element, which is just not part of the picture, because eye for an eye, blah blah blah, it just wasn't there. Mm-hmm. I just think these people had, the Pharisees had no prayer of seeing it different. Mm-hmm. And they should wipe out Jesus because he's an alien, might cause people to not follow God. I mean, he's just like a foreign tribe. Mm-hmm. To them.
And this particular theology, I mean, representatives of this dominant theology will be threatened by any kind of articulation like this that is clearly, you know, that clearly happens beside those who are marginalized by this society. They will be threatened. I mean, the reaction to want to destroy, to seek a way to destroy Jesus, that's part of the picture. Okay, and Lars and I, we've, as we prepared, we talked about how we want to communicate this theology of the cross, you know, which we think is needs to be articulated more and more these days, and you know, but it has to be articulated vis-a-vis the theologies of glory, the theologies of the dominant you know, scene here, and you know, but to do that is, I think, you see how bright the light is, you know, when you go into dark places. And you see how threatening it is when you go into places of oppression. I mean, I witness that. I see what good news it is to the people I work with. And in one of our questions is, how do you make the switch, you know, from one approach to another? And for me, one of the ways that I made the switch is to go with some good news to the places and the people who, you know, who only know the bad news. Because when I can read the scriptures with someone who's submerged by the bad news, it is such a powerful experience, you know, for them and for me, that suddenly I see, wow, there's something very liberating about this, you know. Whereas if I'm just staring at it in the face, you know, or looking at it as a systematic theology or something.
Well, before, it seemed like the focus was totally pleasing God. And then when Jesus came, he seemed to be trying to please the people, please or make their life more pleasing. Where this one, if you're trying to please God, you know, your focus is not on your fellow human being, you're focused on God.
So where is God? Where is the God of Jesus?
He's like got God in him, so he's not focused. Doing something different.
And if we were to look at the question of the cosmology, the cosmological question, like where is God located according to this paradigm, you know, where's God? It's just, you know, God is at table with tax collectors and sinners, and God is out plucking grain in the fields with the disciples, and God is in the temple challenging, you know, the established, the dominant theology, you know, by healing someone. You know, God is in, where else is God? I mean, you know, keep reading through Mark's gospel, through Matthew's gospel, and find out. You know, this is not just the news of these particular verses of just this Gospel of Mark. I mean, you can find this and many other examples that are maybe even more compelling throughout the Scriptures. And that's what we're going to be trying to do in the next times together.
Just to go way off the wall on this, but the God of the Pharisees, and it, you know, and that way. I mean, it would seem, and I've used this illustration before, and I admit it is kind of crazy, but it's to say the God of the Pharisees is alive and well in our secular culture today, not just theologically, but I mean, this God is simply a round, fat, jolly man, and we call him Santa Claus. And to think about that in terms of this, I mean, really, how does Santa Claus act like the God of the Pharisees? Remember that, right? You better watch out. You better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is, and he's got all the omnis, right? He sees you when you're sleeping. Yeah. He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good. So be good for goodness sake. And, you know, there you go. So now we can say, look at that big bad God of the Pharisees. And we've got that distance now. And we go, oh, what a terrible God. But in some senses, that God is alive and well every Christmas when we talk about Santa Claus. Yeah. And it's wonderful, and it's cute, and it's cuddly, and we're all happy and jolly. Ho, ho, ho.
And there are benefits. There are tremendous benefits.
And there are tremendous benefits. Unless, you know, the old comic strip, Calvin and Hobbes, right?
Oh, yeah.
Poor Calvin is terrified by Santa Claus because, you know, after all, Santa Claus is not gracious and merciful, and, you know, he can't throw snowballs at Susie all December long because he wants to get that bite or whatever. And it is sheer terror.
Yeah.
Waiting for Christmas, waiting for the goodies with this legal Santa Claus up there. Absolutely. Holding him under. I mean, it's all there, but look at what a nice, wonderful sense we have of that. So we don't, you know, we don't think it's so bad. But anyway, that's the Scrooges of the world have spoken.
No, but that's critical to point that out. And what Lars was doing is pointing out the positive side of the Pharisees' God. That, I mean, that's critical to really look at carefully, because I'm characterizing this in a way to kind of expose the darkness of this God of the Pharisees. Because it is a dark God, okay? It's an insidious, evil force, okay? It's the evil one, and the evil ones reign, okay? This God of the Pharisees and this God of the status quo. It's what crushes and destroys and oppresses and kills. I know many that have killed themselves, have committed suicide because of these dark images, okay? I know many who are just can't get out from underneath the vices or whatever they're struggling with, you know, because for them, they still just feel like they're under this impossible to please God. They're under the dark shadow. And it's a long process for some people to break out and to be liberated, experience liberation. But it does happen.
That's a big piece of the struggle for me, is because this is nothing new, right? We're reading this out of a 2,000-year-old text. And if this is good news, this God of the Jesus, you know, there's two pieces here now. One is, I don't even know that we should be asking the why questions, but I'm sitting here just at, why does it continue to be just as current? I mean, this is absolutely current event right now. Absolutely current event. And I don't know that we get that it's helpful to ask the why. It's just making, sitting here getting me very angry. Because you talked about secular culture. I mean, I think it's inside the churches is rampant, or more rampant than outside. In some sense, people leave the church to get free of this. And for good reason. God bless them that they recognize that this God is going to kill them.
But the problem is, sometimes they don't really escape. To just leave the church isn't to get out from underneath the oppressive father. You gotta work through the issues.
But at least it's an attempt, I think, to get away. This language here, I mean, is so rare sometimes to hear it. You know, we wait years, or sometimes we don't get it. We commit suicide or die of old age and haven't heard it. So in some sense, I don't know why that we get to ask the why question. But there is in this, like, so what do I do then? If this is a description of reality, I guess that's why it's so helpful for me. This describes reality. It just kind of cracks open the world, and I can see the world in a new way. I can see when the church is making decisions, kind of how it's making decisions, or society making decisions. And does this help me then in making my own decisions and choices for living? And the answer for me has been a clear yes. But not in particularly comfortable ways. Mm-hmm. The most comfortable thing to do is just go back to church Sunday mornings for 1 hour, sing those songs, and have that.
That's the comfort in this.
Yes.
Too, and there is comfort in that. Oh, I have to obey these rules and follow these guidelines.
I mean, that's why I was saying those terms.
And there is comfort in this.
Because it's nice to have a discerning God who's interested in good order, and who just gives me sort of a way to live.
Right.
I mean, over here, it's like, it's radically unpredictable.
Because I have to, take responsibility over there. Here, I just need to follow the rules. There, I've got to be responsible.
Except for the Pharisees would say radically irresponsible, okay? Because you're not ordered. I mean, you end up healing people when really you should be heading to this place. I just think it's so nice to have it up here so clear, and then to recognize that it's so subtle and pervasive in our lives.
But Jesus, he took it on head on. I mean, you know, when he brought the withered man with the withered hand, he said, "Come out." You know, they're in the temple, right? And he knows that this is against the law as it's interpreted by the Pharisees. He says, "Come on out." You know, is it lawful, you know, to do good or to do evil on the Sabbath, you know, to heal or to, you know, whatever words he uses. And then he just immediately, he just challenges these guys directly by healing the person, right? Mm-hmm.
This one on the right is not for the faithless. Mm-hmm. It is not for the faithless.
The one on the left, I can just do on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And so often I would prefer to do it on my own rather than to live in faith. And so we get faith mixed up and say faith is. We call that faith. The church will call that faith a lot of times. At the funeral time, when we talk about how good this person has been, it's basically we're perpetuating the Pharisee. Because that's a, I mean, the big words that I think that ought to go on there, under there for myself is under the Pharisees is the word control. And on the other side is out of control.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Controlling, exactly.
And who wants to be out of control?
And the side that he's writing on now is like constant interruption, no predicting. You got to stop and take care of whatever walks into your path.
If you look at Mark's gospel, it's immediately, there's interruption after interruption. Jesus is just going from, you know, immediately that they said that the mother's, you know, to St. James or Simon or whatever is sick, so immediately he goes and immediately he heals her, and then immediately, it's just like there's constant interruptions.
Right.
And one of the tricky things is, when we say out of control, that means like no accountability, is the way we hear that sometime, right? I mean, I would like a person who understands this God of Jesus, who is Mike's doctor, and if Mike is making every patient sick, I still want that doctor to be accountable, and to call Mike to accountability, and to deal with, so that the patients will be helped. You know, but that's control. I want that CEO to have some control over the performance. So then what's behind this?
See, that's an illusion, though.
It's not an illusion. I know,
but the Pharisee side is, though. They think it's all control, but they're just as powerless as the
They're self. Powerless. Oh, yeah. Like in our area.
They just
drugs.
Think it's better.
But I think another word that I want to get on down here is because I would want Mike CEO, if I've gone in there and gotten sick 10 times in a row, I want him to either get Mike some more training or put him in another position or something like that. But what's underneath this all? You know, on the left side is lack of love. And on the right side is love. And it's a love that's not unaccountable. It still has accountability in it. But it's love.
Jesus interfered with the institutions, which is different from going to the individual, say the individual doctor who wasn't performing well. But how is the system set up to keep somebody like that in place? It's a big difference between wanting to have someone fired and wanting to do away with the institution that would nurture a person who's not performing.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that one other important distinction to make between these two gods is that God of violence and nonviolence too. Just Jesus' strong commitment to nonviolence in comparison to the God of the Pharisees. I mean, if we assume that they're acting the way they believe their God wants them to act when they're plotting for the death of
Christ.
Violent and
exactly. You know,
that's kind of the cap of the whole thing after all those things.
But one thing that's interesting, Jesus is not, his main focus is not to challenge the Pharisees. His main focus is to heal the brokenhearted and to cast out the demons and to go out and to preach the good news. And he runs into the Pharisees because they're in the audience and they're critiquing him and they're judging him and they're challenged by him. They feel subverted by him. Okay, but his main purpose is not to challenge institutions. It's to reach out and to heal and to meet individuals along the way everywhere. It's just, you know, encounter after encounter.
Which I think is a big problem for a lot of people. I mean, to conceptualize a God who is like me
is a lot harder to swallow and wrap my brain around than it is to conceptualize a God who is up there and controlling and knows all and knows my future and knows what I'm going to do. And I mean, I've got a lot of friends who would not be able to accept the concept of that God, mm-hmm. because God isn't here. God is there.
Yeah.
And it's this whole, I mean, it's this whole separation thing. And how, you know, and as I'm sitting here, and to me, this just makes sense. I mean, Lars and I have talked about this. But how do I bring that to someone who can't even
That's the whole challenge, is how do we identify God as present with us in the midst of our suffering? How do we discern the presence of the Spirit? And to me, that's what my job is all about. It's just helping accompany people in that process of identifying the movement of God in their life, you know? And that's not always evident. I mean, it wasn't evident in Jesus' time.
Right.
Either.